across the ocean, from sea to shining sea. Different kinds of people sing a sweet harmony. Take a look around you, think about what you see. We can live together, side by side, you and me. One song that the whole world can sing, one voice that together will bring, one hope that above everything the whole world can sing. One song. Everyone's a brother or a sister that you meet. We are all one family, living on the same street. So let's sing together a song with beautiful sound. All the music that we make, we'll spread love all around. One song that the whole world can sing, one voice that together we'll bring, one hope that above everything the whole world can sing. One song.
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us at accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com and hear this program and past programs, or you can friend us on Facebook. Today's program, Scott Horton interviews the other Scott Horton. The other Scott Horton is an international human rights lawyer and contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. They discuss the spreading of American ideas through education instead of with bombs. They also talk about why a one-world government is not a realistic possibility.
I'm Scott Horton, and my next guest on the show is the other Scott Horton, the heroic anti-torture human rights attorney. Writes for Harper's.org, legal affairs journalist there, and keeps the blog No Comment. Welcome back to the show, Scott. How's things?
Great to be with you. Things are going well. We're getting ready for a hurricane party here in New York City right now, you know.
Is it getting that far north?
Yeah, well, you know, we're going to get some rain. It's not going to be anything serious here.
Oh, okay. That would be kind of fun to see big waves off the coast of New York like that. It always seems so calm in the pictures, you know? Like the city is built a couple of feet above sea level, and that's it.
Yeah, well, I've seen times when the streetlights were bending over from the wind. So it does hit. You know, we do get hit by hurricanes once in a while, but it's only every few years.
That's cool, man. I've never even been to New York. I ought to go sometime. Hopefully, you know, when it's not the target of any reprisal attacks on America, which it's likely to be again at some point. Seems like. But anyway, part of your bio is that you are the co-founder of the American University in Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan. If I'm even saying the name of the country right, which I'm Sure, I'm probably not. Can you tell us about that project a little bit and then tell us about what's going on in Kyrgyzstan now? But I'm just interested in the story of you being the co-founder of a university over there in the middle of the old world where you can't even get there from anywhere.
Well, that started about 15 years ago, and I was doing a lot of work out in Central Asia, spending a lot of time in Central and Kyrgyzstan in particular, and you got the pronunciation pretty well. One thing I was really impressed with was the educators there. In fact, the president at that time was a former college professor, and they were really enthusiastic about the American idea of higher education, the liberal arts and sciences college, and really wanted to set up something on the American model. And so it was an initiative that started with the people in Central Asia to try and create an American-style college, and it won the support of a number of philanthropists and the U.S. government, and got launched beginning in 1995. And now we've got a campus and 1,200 students there.
Wow, that's really great. It's almost like you could teach a neocon a thing or two about spreading liberty around the world, huh?
Well, I know some prominent neocons who go out there and visit, and they all come away impressed and have more than once told me that, you know, it's clear that, in fact, we have more impact on this region through education and through teaching college courses than we've ever had by dropping bombs and using rifles. I think there's just no doubt about that. It's clearly the case.
Yeah, and then their next sentence is, so we ought to start a war there and start bombing people, right?
Well, the follow-up is that they don't draw the obvious inference, which is that there are many more effective tools than war. Although, you know, I think there are a handful of neocons who, you know, after the experiences of Iraq and Afghanistan, have come to realize that they shouldn't jump immediately to dropping 2,000-pound bombs on places. There may be other more effective tools.
Well, and I think, you know, I would make the case probably that some of the more kind of intellectual, academic and writer neocon types, not the most crass, you know, war propagandists at the Weekly Standard and whatever, but some of the intellectual neocons, I think, really did believe in that spreading liberty thing, and maybe even Paul Wolfowitz. But, you know, with Richard Perle and Scooter Libby and Douglas Feith, those guys weren't trying to spread liberty to anybody. That was a bunch of propaganda for the rubes, probably including the president.
Yeah, the real question I think you see is when they launch these campaigns, what is the attitude towards the locals? I mean, do they embrace them? Do they have a positive attitude towards them, wanting to help them and improve their condition? Or do they just view them as, you know, chattel? I think, you know, the experience certainly in both Iraq and Afghanistan has been a mixed experience. So there's been some outreach and some attempts to protect. On the other hand, you know, measures are taken that produce far too many civilian casualties. And even Stanley McChrystal, you know, his final couple of months as he was on the way out there, he was openly and sharply critical of the tactics the U.S. had used in Afghanistan. He said that there had been far too many civilian casualties and that it resulted from the U.S. and U.S. soldiers not willing to be able to accept the level of risk that they, in fact, should accept for a mission of the kind that they were engaged in.
All right, well, and that's true. And he also said every time you kill one, you create 10 more, which I only wish that people could, you know, try that on and then look back at the last 20, 30 years of history instead of, you know, from September 11th on only. But anyway, looking forward, does it do any good to kill anybody in Afghanistan if every time you kill someone, you make 10 more enemies? Other than nuking the place with H-bombs, what good does any of this do as far as defeating the enemy there? I mean,
yeah, well, we've had something of a roller coaster in Afghanistan. The situation there now is about as bad as it's been, you know, since the year after the defeat of the Taliban. And that's after a tremendous outpouring of resources from the United States, money, development assistance, and security assistance. We're seeing, a collapse of the position of the government, and most recently, a collapse of the banking sector in Afghanistan.
Yeah. Boy, in fact, thanks for reminding me, because I wanted to try to remember to play my Bart Simpson clip where he causes a run on the bank just by saying, like, hey, what do you mean they're out of money? And then all of a sudden everybody panics and the bank closes. It's really that easy, isn't it? Especially in Afghanistan. They don't have the reserve currency of the world there.
That's exactly right. In fact, you know, the de facto currency of Afghanistan is not the Afghan, it's the U.S. dollar.
Yeah, well, and they're going to get their bailout, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. I strongly suspect they will. I mean, I think this is another one of these situations where Washington is going to say they're too big to fail.
Yeah.
Exactly. All right. Well, so let's take a couple of minutes as we come up on this first break here, well, on the one break here, Scott, and why don't you teach us a little bit about the Kurgas in general? Then maybe when we come back, a little bit about, you know, what's actually going on there, the American Empire and Russia's influence there, et cetera.
Well, they're the, I think they're, as Eugene Husky, my friend down at Stetson University, says, they're natural-born anarchists. You know, the Kurgas were a nomadic people dragged kicking and screaming into the Soviet empire, you know, in the early 20th century. But they always maintained their own parallel nomadic society, and they had a tradition that was really somewhat different from most of the other Central Asians. In that they would pick their own leaders at periodic gatherings or assemblies they called the Kurultai. And if their leader wasn't performing up to snuff or did something bad or made some foolish mistake, they would just dump him. In fact, they would do that with regularity. And one thing we see is now Kyrgyzstan's an independent country with its own sovereignty and its own institutions, and they have distinguished themselves from all the other Central Asians by toppling their leaders with some frequency now. Because we're on, you know, this year we have the second revolution within 5 years in Kyrgyzstan. New government coming in, struggling to establish itself and winding its way towards parliamentary election in October. And that's the real focus there right now. U.S. and Russia, major powers on the periphery, both with big interests there, both with military installations there. And the Kyrgyz basically want everybody to be their friend. They're perfectly happy to accommodate the Americans. They've offered the Americans space for more bases if the U.S. wants it. They've made the same offers to the Russians and to the Chinese. They feel that they benefit from the presence of all these military installations.
Boy, as long as these major powers don't break out into a fight on their territory.
That's correct. But, you know, they had a meltdown in the beginning of June with ethnic riots that occurred in Osh, in the southern part of the country, and the Kyrgyz invited both the U.S. and the Russians to send troops to help them quell it. And both the U.S. and the Russians said, no, thank you.
Well, that's better than them working together, like in that Chuck Norris movie Delta Force 2 or whatever, where they invade Iraq together. I kind of worry about that. I mean, I don't like the new Cold War as it is, but I kind of worry about, you know, a Russia-American alliance over the long term, Army of the North. Like, you know, there were a lot of people trying to include Russia into NATO toward the end of the Clinton years. Yeah, all right. Well, now, I think let's hold that thought right there, and we'll come back to it. It's the other Scott Horton, anti-torture human rights lawyer from Harper's Magazine and Columbia University on Anti-War Radio. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. On the Antiwar.com, Scott Horton. The Anti-War Radio, Scott Horton. And on the line is the other Scott Horton, or maybe I'm the other Scott Horton to him. But anyway, for purposes of this show, he's the other Scott Horton. He's a heroic international human rights lawyer. He teaches law at Columbia University in New York. He's the co-founder of the American University in Bishkek, and was the chair of the New York Bar Association's Committee on Human Rights and International Law, and on. That's just from what I remember off the top of my head. Go read his bio at harpers.org. Read his blog, no comment, harpers.org. Now, Scott, back when I was a kid, George H.W. Bush used to talk about the New World Order. And I used to think that that meant that now that the Cold War was over, that it was sort of a Hegelian dialectic kind of a thing, right? You have your thesis, your antithesis, and your synthesis. So you have these two former opposites in the bipolar world. And then now, I remember even reading an interview of Vladimir Zhirinovsky, the hardcore right-winger Russian in, say, 96, 97, saying that, yeah, this is the deal. Now we will join together in one big alliance of the white North versus particularly the Islamic southern border of Russia. He saw that America would have a problem with the Muslims in the future in extending our hegemony over that part of the world, and he saw that they had the same problem that we did, and that this is the natural alliance. I think Tom Clancy even wrote a book where there's a war with China, and we bring Russia into NATO, and this is the way they had the Russian NATO Council and all these kinds of things. And then it turned out that maybe the New World Order, as meant by Dick Cheney and Scooter Libby, just meant the U.S. government lording it over everybody, including the Russians, and that this alliance isn't going to happen after all. And so I just wonder what you think about all those crazy things I just said.
Well, I think, you know, we definitely did enter into a new stage of world history following the collapse of the Soviet Union, because the world had been really dominated by an ideologically based struggle between the market economies and the socialist nations, the Soviet bloc and China, the communist nations, up to that point. And today, I think, you know, Marxism is a spent force intellectually, certainly on the world political stage it is. And we moved to a new era. And I think a lot of people thought, and I think this is really what was behind Bush's idea of a new world order, that we had reached this this Hegelian sort of end times, and that the end times were the triumph of free market liberalism, by which I don't mean liberalism the way, you know, we talk about it in politics in the United States today, but liberalism in the sense of Adam Smith and David Ricardo, classical liberalism, market economics. I think now it's pretty clear that that's not the case, that, you know, we do have a world that's dominated to an extent by market economics, but we have an alternative model that's been embraced, especially on the territory of these formerly communist countries, and that is of a sort of state capitalism. And I think that's what we see today in Russia and China. And there certainly are frictions between, you know, our Western idea of market economics and theirs, but they're nowhere nearly as acute as they were during the Soviet era. In fact, I'd say, you know, broadly, there's been quite a bit of convergence between the United States and Russia since the fall of communism. The countries have come closer and closer together, but that has not been all just Russia accepting our notions of economics and our political models, our ideas of democracy, because it's clear they've not fully assumed either of those things. Rather, to a certain extent, it's been the United States converging much more closely towards the Russian model of a national security state. So it's been some, I think, some very negative developments on our side, too. So if we look today at the world in terms of, let's call it the surveillance state, countries and governments that have the capacity and the ability to snoop on everybody, including their own citizens, there are four nations in the world that stand out at the top of the pyramid that have the most aggressive surveillance state, and those are Russia, the United States, the UK, and China. Absolutely at the peak of this pyramid.
All right. Well, so now that kind of fits my model as far as, you know, it was a simplistic thing. I'm saying, I guess, my view of the world, the way it was working and where we were headed in the 1990s. We become more like them. They become more like us until our systems are compatible. After all, that was what Rowan Gaither, the head of the Ford Foundation, said back in 1953. Our goal is to eventually merge comfortably with the Soviet Union and create a world state. But Dick Cheney said, nah, screw the UN Security Council, man. We have the National Security Council. We can do whatever we want. And Vladimir Putin basically did a coup against the drunk puppet Yeltsin. And he's a nationalist and a patriot. And he's not putting up with sacrificing his independence to America. Doesn't seem like. So where are we in this?
I mean, you know, in fact, I've spent quite a bit of time, you know, studying Putin and his theories about the state and his theories about national security. And I would say at the end of the day, you could put Putin together in a pea pod with Richard Bruce Cheney. Their views are almost identical. They both fall into the same category of what we would call great nation conservatism. They're convinced of the righteousness and rightness of their country. They don't want it to be constrained by anybody's laws or limitations. They want it to be able to exercise power violently as it needs to. And I think one of the reasons that Cheney despised Putin so much and that Putin despised Cheney is there's so much alike.
Yeah. Well, you know, as long as they don't nuke each other with hydrogen bombs, I prefer that Russia stay independent from America. It seems like when Boris Yeltsin was over there that the Americans just completely took advantage and, you know, instead of trying to build up the Soviet economy and give them a helping hand, they just kicked them while they were down and liquidated all their debt and helped a bunch of Israelis run off with all the money and a bunch of oligarchs and criminals take over. They needed somebody like KGB Putin to take over that country. Didn't
well, I think, you know, the idea of one world government is some of the greatest nonsense of the last century. It's really weak-minded people who think that way. And in fact, you know, there's never really been any serious movement towards one world government. What there has been is a movement towards international organizations that can act as some sort of effective brake on warfare and conflict. But there's no way that these organizations are ever going to assume some sort of global governance role. I think that's just a ridiculous idea.
Well, I mean, if Russia joins NATO, then that's your world army right there, right?
Which is, and of course, we've defined for a generation, we've defined NATO as a consolidated force opposing Russia. So if Russia became a member of it, it would really cease to have any purpose.
No, then we'd just use it against Iran or whoever else, invade Africa.
Well, there are people who think that way, but this is not going to happen.
Well, good. I mean, you know, I got to tell you, I thought I was right up until the Iraq War when I saw that Colin Powell really tried to, we got to go through the UN. He convinced Bush to go through the UN. Cheney wanted to just go right ahead. Yeah. And I thought, and I also thought that they would try to make the deal sweet for the Russians and the French on the Security Council, even the Chinese, and say, well, you guys can have the oil in the north and we'll take the oil in the south, and that it would be a UN war. And it did not work out that way. And I realized that the way I saw the world just wasn't making sense. Dick Cheney did not believe, he certainly didn't carry out that war the way Bill Clinton would have carried out that war.
I think that's right. And of course, a lot of people forget that they think of the United Nations as the institution that arose at the end of World War II, and they tend to forget that actually the United Nations had its first incarnation during World War II. That was the formal name of the military alliance that the U.S. led against the Axis powers.
Right.
Why you wanna trip? now for something completely different.